McLaren versus the Commonwealth. Mr. Adair, you're with us, and Ms. Mishar, you're with us?
Yes, sir. Good morning.
All right, good morning. All right, well, Mr. Adair, we're ready to hear from you. Do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, Your Honor.
5 minutes, yes, sir. All right, we're ready.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. This matter comes on a conviction of Mr. McLaren for possession with intent to distribute marijuana and simple possession of Xanax. It is a constructive possession case that arises out of a search of a residence in Prince William County, where at the time of the search, Mr. McLaren was not present. And at the trial, no evidence or testimony was elicited to suggest that Mr. McLaren had ever been at the residence.
Mr. Davis, let me cut real fast to what the issue to me is. This case seems to be very, very close factually to the Supreme Court's opinion in Cordon and our recent unpublished opinion in Booth. The Attorney General has done her best job to distinguish those cases, and I'd like to know your position on whether she has been successful, or if not, why they control.
Yes, Your Honor. I would contend that the Attorney General has not been successful. I certainly understand the arguments that were made, but in trying to distinguish the documents that were found in the residence in this case and suggesting why they are more important, I think the Attorney General places an unreasonable emphasis on the importance to a defendant of a misdemeanor summons, indicating that from the Attorney General's point of view, this is a thing that a potential defendant would not let out of their sight because it is so important to them because of the legal obligations that it stands for, which you know, a summons is not a golden ticket. You're not required to submit it to the bailiff as you enter the courtroom. The important thing, information that is on the summons is merely a date which someone can clearly set up in their calendar or remember that that's the day that they need to be in court. There's nothing special about that piece of paper, and I would suggest that's even more applicable at this point where we have online case information where someone knowing the county in which they have a charge and their own last name are able to find all of the relevant information that would be from the front of the summons, and that there is nothing sort of special about that that would cause someone not to let it out of their sight. The second document that the Attorney General focuses on is this medical identification card, and makes argument there. I think, unfortunately for the Attorney General, none of that argument or suggestion occurs at the trial. And in fact, there is no testimony, and the court does not take any judicial notice of what the role of this medical assistance card is. The Attorney General speculates in argument that this would be required to be presented at the point that the defendant would seek any sort of future medical care. And I just don't think there's anything in the record that would support that contention. So between those two items, and those are really the only two items that the Commonwealth seeks to distinguish, in Cordon, you've got documents, you have checks, you have, in fact, a police business card that was given to the defendant a mere two days before the search occurred, that is found in the bedroom that the defendant has identified as his, at least prior to the search warrant, in the nightstand. During that two-day period, the Supreme Court seemed to suggest that that was a significant enough break that it broke any sort of inference that Cordon had control, dominion and control over the items in that room. Further, in Cordon, aside from the inference that can be drawn out of him at first claiming the bedroom is his and then denying it's his once he finds out there's contraband, that is on top of what I would suggest is a heavier weight of evidence in terms of identification documents and items belonging to Cordon that were found there. That additional inference was still not enough to push that case over the line such that the Supreme Court believed that there would have been, you know, evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that he constructively possessed those items. Now, what is like Cordon is that the sort of object within which the drugs were occurred in which the drugs were present, a cooler in that case, the Supreme Court found that a cooler was sort of an inherently movable object. Well, in this case, like Corton, the marijuana is found in a backpack, I would suggest, if not at least as, perhaps even more inherently movable than a cooler. The record is silent as to where exactly in the room the Xanax was found, but it is, this case is like Corton in that that inherently movable object is where the contraband was discovered. And I just don't think that the Commonwealth, that the Attorney General has created really any distinction here between this case and Corton, or the case that was cited in my original brief, Garland, wherein an expired driver's license and a lease listing the defendant as the co-tenant of the property for the period in which the search occurred, that those were not enough either. Sort of eerily similar in that we're talking about an expired driver's license. So that would be my answer to that question. Beth, do we have anything else you'd like to hear specifically on that issue, Judge? Thank you. So here we have, like I said, the portable item that the drugs are contained in. We have no evidence that the police ever observed Mr. McLaurin going into this residence. We have no testimony from anyone other than police officers. So there are no other tenants of the property or any of the other people who were charged upon the execution of the search warrant who would suggest that Mr. McLaurin had ever been to this place. I think you mentioned Booth, wherein Judge O'Brien mentions that there's a constructive possession requires some sufficient evidence of simultaneity between the defendant's presence and the seizure of the contraband, and then goes on to cite two cases, Hall versus Commonwealth, 69 Virginia at 437, wherein in addition to items of contraband, mail, bills in the defendant's name, titles of vehicles in the defendant's name, and medication for the defendant and her child that were found there, those were supplemented by the fact that the police observed the defendant leaving the residence on the morning of the search warrant was executed. We see nothing like that in this case. And also Sherbaji versus Commonwealth, 18 Virginia App, 415, wherein a number of items were found connecting the defendant to the contraband. And in fact, the defendant arrived during the execution of the search warrant and turned around and drove away. And among those items that were found were personal papers and envelopes addressed to him at the search residence. We have nothing like this in this case. In fact, the address listed on the expired ID and the address listed on the summons were for a residence in Fairfax County, not for anything in Prince William, much less the Lakota Drive address. So I would suggest that there is nothing in the record that would suggest any simultaneity of Mr. McLaurin being present at the apartment at the time that the alleged contraband would be there. And further, given the inherently movable nature of the backpack wherein the drugs were found, even if you were to believe that Mr. McLaurin had at some point been to this residence after that summons was issued, that summons was issued more than a month prior to the date of the search. Now, in Corton, the court found that 2 days was sufficient to sort of break the connection between Mr. Corton and that bedroom. Well, in this case, we have more than a month. So even if Mr. McLaurin had been there at some point during that month, given the inherently movable nature of the backpack, it's certainly possible that someone else who had residence there or had visited that apartment had placed the backpack in the back left bedroom, a bedroom that the police would suggest there was no lock on, that did not have any sort of other identifying documents, that had multiple beds, an apartment that was, by the officer's own testimony, quite messy. And from the pictures that were admitted into evidence and that are included as part of the record here, I think would support that this was a messy back left bedroom. Now, the Commonwealth goes on to further draw another connection between the summons and the ID. First, that the summons was found in a storage bin where Officer Seekley would suggest that there were also loaded handgun magazines, and suggest that loaded handgun magazines are sort of an incidence of drug distribution. Well, that's not exactly what Officer Siegley testified it to, he testified that that firearms are associated with that. There wasn't a firearm found, and I understand that might be sort of a ticky-tack distinction, but in fact, you know, magazines loaded or otherwise are not guns themselves. There's nothing illegal about their possession, assuming that there's not a prohibition on the individual who possesses them having them. And frankly, in the absence of the drugs there, they really do nothing. And what we have is sort of some bootstrapping going on here, that because the summons was found, you know, in proximity to the magazine, that this means that the person the summons was issued to must be involved in the distribution of drugs. Well, given the inherently movable nature of the container the drugs were in, I think that's a stretch. Additionally, the expired ID that was found on the TV stand was found in proximity to a digital scale, while
Mr. Dare, just so you're aware, you're in your rebuttal time, which is fine, but I just want to make sure you're aware.
Thank you, Judge. I'll reserve the remainder.
All right, you have 4 minutes remaining.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Mishar.
Thank you, and may it please the court, Maureen Mishar for the Commonwealth. This court should affirm the judgment of the Circuit Court for Prince William County because the trial judge was not plainly wrong in convicting McLaurin, and its judgment had evidence to support it. I think jumping straight to the heart of the matter, this case obviously is a case involving constructive possession, and oftentimes in these types of possession with intent to distribute narcotics cases, they rely on circumstantial evidence. In this case, the Commonwealth's argument is hinged on those three items belonging to McLaurin that were discovered alongside evidence of drug distribution that were also discovered in the same back bedroom in that Lakota Drive apartment. Judge Petty kind of cut straight to the chase, and so I'd like to do that as well with my argument. I tried on brief to distinguish...
Counsel, excuse me, this is Judge Frank. Are you familiar
with... Yes, sir, good morning.
Good morning. Are you familiar with Drew versus Commonwealth 230 Virginia 471?
Yes, Judge. That I believe was a 1986 case.
It was.
Where, yes, sir. Where the Supreme Court, if I'm not mistaken, similar facts where there was a search warrant of a house. Well, I don't want to recite the facts for the court unless it's necessary, but
yes, Frank, I think I know what you're talking about.
Well, let me tell you the facts. If you don't remember, they found, Supreme Court reversed the conviction. They found a checkbook, bank statement, telephone bill, and a wallet containing vehicle registration cards, driver's license, and a credit union voucher, all in the name of the defendant. And the Supreme Court said that's not enough.
Yes.
You want to
I think to follow up, they also said the proximity to the dwelling was not enough because I think in that case, the defendant was observed by police outside the house a few cars down even. Police have been conducting surveillance, I believe, of the house, and 22 people were observed going in and out of the residence during that time. And the court held that the issue of being the awareness of the presence and the subject of cocaine being subject to a dominion control of that issue. I think in my attempt to distinguish that case, Judge Frank, I would say that unlike in the Drew case, there was no evidence in the record that multiple people were going in and out of that back bedroom. The record is silent, in fact, about who was going in and out of that back bedroom. We know there were other people in the house, but nothing related to that back bedroom. And we also know that the only items belonging to any individual discussed in the record were tied to McLaurin. So unlike a living room in Drew, where there were items belonging to Mr. Drew, in this case, this was confined to a back bedroom where there was no evidence in the record of anything else being tied to another individual. Everything was tied to Mr. McLaurin. And what I mean by everything, of course, I'm limiting to what we have in the record, which is that summons, the medical ID card, and that expired Walker's ID. So in an attempt to distinguish Drew, I would say we don't have the people going in and out that the court had in that case. Although, of course, my case, I'm also limited to the fact that we don't have evidence that Mr. McLaurin was observed by police in that bedroom either. So I think my argument has to be that what we do have is that summons, that medical ID card, and that expired locker's ID card that are all purported to belong to Mr. McLaurin in this case. Thank you, Judge. So I think Corden and Booth obviously are difficult cases to distinguish, but I think, again, in this case, what's interesting is the fact that some of the items belonging to Mr. McLaurin in this back bedroom, counsel highlights that they had a different address in Fairfax County, but I think that might cut both ways. And it's interesting that there are two items that have the same Fairfax County address that are found in separate locations within this apartment in Prince William County. There is a hypothesis of innocence presented to the trial court, which the trial court rejected, that counsel had said perhaps these items were lost or part of a wallet that was lost or forgotten. But the trial court rejected that and said that would defy common sense to believe that Mr. McLaurin did not exercise dominion and control over this room, because what the evidence is that there is that summons that was personally served on him that has that different address in Fairfax County, along with another expired ID card that has that different address in Fairfax County, and somehow both of those documents found themselves to be in that same back bedroom in Prince William County. So I think when we're looking at the standard of review here and whether or not a rational trier of fact could have found the evidence sufficient, I would argue to the court, understanding, of course, the court's concerns about the evidence in this case, I would argue to the court that the judge in this case, Judge Hudson, was a rational trier of fact, and he found the evidence was sufficient. And based on the evidence that we have, I would argue that he was not plainly wrong and ask the court to affirm that decision. And so unless the court has other questions for me, that's where I think the Kamal's argument must stand.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Mishar. Mr. Adair, you have four minutes remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. What I would suggest is that in Horton and Booth and Garland and Drew, in all of those cases, a trier of fact who was given deference for their finding was still overturned. I think that certainly Judge Hudson did hear the evidence and did come to the conclusion that he did, but I'm asking you to overturn that because I do think that it was an irrational finding given the evidence that was in the record. The Attorney General suggests that the fact that these two items had the same address that was different from the residence where it was found cuts both ways, that somehow that supports the idea that there's a stronger link to Mr. McLaurin than in the cases where we have actual envelopes that are addressed to the defendant at the location that is being searched, or personal checks that are found there, or credit cards. And it's just, I think that defies common sense, frankly, to suggest that is a stronger link than in these other cases where the Supreme Court has found that there was an insufficient link to establish that the defendant exerted dominion and control or had knowledge of the drugs or other contraband that was found in those places. As in the Commonwealth suggests in Drew that, it was observation somehow cuts both ways because there were multiple individuals observed going in and out of the residence, and that Mr. McLaurin was never observed in the back bedroom. But in fact, Mr. McLaurin was never observed at all. These warrants were issued entirely in his absence. He didn't show up during the execution of the warrant. He wasn't seen before the execution of the warrant. There is just literally nothing other than these documents that connect him to this property. And I would suggest that is simply insufficient, and that is why we would ask the court to overturn the conviction.
All right, well, thank you very much. We appreciate the argument. The case is submitted, and you'll hear from us shortly. That concludes the docket for this morning. The